Author's Foreword. This book is, strictly speaking, not a sequel, because it begins about where Ender's Game begins and also ends very nearly at the same place. In fact, it's another telling of the same tale, with many of the same characters and settings, only from the perspective of another character. It's hard to know what to call it, a companion novel, a parallel novel, perhaps a parallax, if I can move that scientific term into literature. Ideally, this novel should work as well for readers who have never read Ender's Game as for those who have read it several times. Because it is not a sequel, there's nothing you need to know from the novel Ender's Game that is not contained here. And yet, if I have achieved my literary goal, these two books complement and fulfill each other. Whichever one you read first, the other novel should still work on its own merits. For many years, I have gratefully watched as Ender's Game has grown in popularity, especially among school-age readers. Though it was never intended as a young adult novel, it has been embraced by many in that age group and by many teachers who find ways to use the book in their classrooms. I've never found it surprising that the existing sequels, Speaker for the Dead, Xenocide, and Children of the Mind, never appealed as strongly to those younger readers. The obvious reason is that Ender's Game is centered around a child, while the sequels are about adults. Perhaps more important, Ender's Game is, at least on the surface, a heroic, adventurous novel, while the sequels are a completely different kind of fiction, slower-paced, more contemplative and idea-centered, and dealing with themes of less immediate import to younger readers. Recently, however, I have come to realize that the 3,000-year gap between Ender's Game and its sequels leaves plenty of room for other sequels that are more closely tied to the original. In fact, in one sense, Ender's Game has no sequels, for the other three books make one continuous story in themselves, while Ender's Game stands alone. For a brief time, I flirted seriously with the idea of opening up the Ender's Game universe to other writers, and went so far as to invite a writer whose work I greatly admire, Neil Schusterman, to consider working with me to create novels about Ender Wiggins' companions in battle school. As we talked, it became clear that the most obvious character to begin with would be Bean, the child soldier whom Ender treated as he had been treated by his adult teachers. And then something else happened. The more we talked, the more jealous I became that Neil might be the one to write such a book, and not me. It finally dawned on me that far from being finished with writing about kids in space, as I cynically described the project, I actually had more to say, having actually learned something in the intervening dozen years since Ender's Game first appeared in 1985. And so, while still hoping that Neil and I can work together on something, I deftly swiped the project back. I soon found that it's harder than it looks to tell the same story twice, but differently. I was hindered by the fact that even though the viewpoint characters were different, the author was the same, with the same core beliefs about the world. I was helped by the fact that in the intervening years, I have learned a few things and was able to bring different concerns and a deeper understanding to the project. Both books come from the same mind, but not the same. They draw on the same memories of childhood, but from a different perspective. For the reader, the parallax is created by Ender and Bean, standing a little ways apart as they move through the same events. For the writer, the parallax was created by a dozen years in which my older children grew up and younger ones were born, and the world changed around me, and I learned a few things about human nature and about art that I had not known before. And now you're listening to this book. Whether the literary experiment succeeds for you is entirely up to you to judge. For me, it was worth dipping again into the same well, for the water was greatly changed this time. And if it has not been turned exactly into wine, at least it has a different flavor because of the different vessel that it was carried in. And I hope that you will enjoy it as much, or even more. Greensboro, North Carolina, January 1999.
Audio Renaissance presents Ender's Shadow by Orson Scott Card. Read for you by Scott Brick and Gabrielle DeCure. With Stefan Rudnicki, Stephen Hoy, Eric Luke, Christian Noble, Victoria Von Roth, and Orson Scott Card. Part 1. Urchin. Chapter 1. Poke.
You think you found somebody, so suddenly my program gets the axe?
It's not about this kid that Graf found. It's about the low quality of what you've been finding.
We knew it was long odds. But the kids I'm working with are actually fighting a war just to stay alive.
Your kids are so malnourished that they suffer serious mental degradation before you even begin testing them. Most of them haven't formed any normal human bonds. They're so messed up they can't get through a day without finding something they can steal, break, or disrupt.
They also represent possibility, as all children do.
That's just the kind of sentimentality that discredits your whole project in the eyes of the IF.
Poke kept her eyes open all the time. The younger children were supposed to be on watch, too, and sometimes they could be quite observant, but they just didn't notice all the things they needed to notice, and that meant that Poke could only depend on herself to see danger. There was plenty of danger to watch for. The cops, for instance. They didn't show up often, but when they did, they seemed especially bent on clearing the streets of children. They would flail them with their magnetic whips, landing cruel, stinging blows on even the smallest children, haranguing them as vermin, thieves, pestilence, a plague on the fair city of Rotterdam. It was Polk's job to notice when a disturbance in the distance suggested that the cops might be running a sweep. Then she would give the alarm whistle, and the little ones would rush to their hiding places till the danger was past. But the cops didn't come by that often. The real danger was much more immediate. Big kids. Poke, at age 9, was the matriarch of her little crew. Not that any of them knew for sure that she was a girl. But that cut no ice with the 11 and 12 and 13-year-old boys and girls who bullied their way around the streets. The adult-sized beggars and thieves and whores of the street paid no attention to the little kids except to kick them out of the way. But the older children, who were among the kicked, turned around and preyed on the younger ones. Anytime Polk's crew found something to eat, especially if they located a dependable source of garbage or an easy mark for a coin or a bit of food, they had to watch jealously and hide their winnings, for the bullies liked nothing better than to take away whatever scraps of food the little ones might have. Stealing from younger children was much safer than stealing from shops or passers-by. And they enjoyed it. Poke could see that. They liked how the little kids cowered and obeyed and whimpered and gave them whatever they demanded. So when the scrawny little 2-year-old took up a perch on a garbage can across the street, Poke, being observant, saw him at once. The kid was on the edge of starvation. No, the kid was starving. Thin arms and legs, joints that looked ridiculously oversized, a distended belly. And if hunger didn't kill him soon, the onset of autumn would, because his clothing was thin, and there wasn't much of it even at that. Normally she wouldn't have paid him more than passing attention. But this one had eyes. He was still looking around with intelligence. None of that stupor of the walking dead, no longer searching for food or even caring to find a comfortable place to lie while breathing their last taste of the stinking air of Rotterdam. After all, death would not be such a change for them. Everyone knew that Rotterdam was, if not the capital, than the main seaport of hell. The only difference between Rotterdam and death was that with Rotterdam, the damnation wasn't eternal. This little boy, what was he doing? Not looking for food. He wasn't eyeing the pedestrians, which was just as well. There was no chance that anyone would leave anything for a child that small. Anything he might get would be taken away by any other child, so why should he bother? If he wanted to survive, he should be following older scavengers and licking food wrappers behind them, getting the last sheen of sugar or dusting of flour clinging to the packaging, whatever the first comer hadn't licked off. There was nothing for this child out here on the street, not unless he got taken in by a crew, and Poke wouldn't have him. He'd be nothing but a drain, and her kids were already having a hard enough time without adding another useless mouth. He's going to ask, she thought. He's going to whine and beg, but that only works on the rich people. I've got my crew to think of. He's not one of them, so I don't care about him, even if he is small. He's nothing to me. A couple of 12-year-old hookers who didn't usually work this strip rounded a corner, heading toward Poke's base. She gave a low whistle. The kids immediately drifted apart, staying on the street but trying not to look like a crew. It didn't help. The hookers knew already that Poke was a crew boss, and sure enough, they caught her by the arms and slammed her against a wall and demanded their permission fee. Poke knew better than to claim she had nothing to share. She always tried to keep a reserve in order to placate hungry bullies. These hookers, Poke could see why they were hungry. They didn't look like what the pedophiles wanted when they came cruising through. They were too gaunt, too old-looking. So until they grew bodies and started attracting the slightly less perverted trade, they had to resort to scavenging. It made Poke's blood boil to have them steal from her and her crew, but it was smarter to pay them off. If they beat her up, she couldn't look out for her crew, now could she? So she took them to one of her stashes and came up with a little bakery bag that still had half a pastry in it. It was stale, since she'd been holding it for a couple of days for just such an occasion, but the two hookers grabbed it, tore open the bag, and one of them bit off more than half before offering the remainder to her friend. Or rather, her former friend, for of such predatory acts are feuds born. The two of them started fighting, screaming at each other, slapping, raking at each other with clawed hands. Poke watched closely, hoping that they'd drop the remaining fragment of pastry. But no such luck. It went into the mouth of the same girl who had already eaten the first bite. And it was that first girl who won the fight, too, sending the other one running for refuge. Poke turned around, and there was the little boy right behind her. She nearly tripped over him. Angry as she was at having had to give up food to those street horse, she gave him a knee and knocked him to the ground. "Don't stand behind people if you don't want to land on your butt," she snarled. He simply got up and looked at her, expectant, demanding. "No, you little bastard, you're not getting nothing from me," said Poke. "I'm not taking one bean out of the mouths of my crew. You aren't worth a bean." Her crew was starting to reassemble now that the bullies had passed. "Why you give your food to them?" said the boy. "You need that food." "Oh, excuse me," said Poke. She raised her voice so her crew could hear her. "I guess you ought to be the crew boss here, is that it? You being so big, you got no trouble keeping the food."
"Not me," said the boy. "I'm not worth a bean, remember?"
"Yeah, I remember. Maybe you ought to remember and shut up." Her crew laughed. But the little boy didn't.
"You got to get your own bully," he said.
"I don't get bullies, I get rid of them," Poke answered. She didn't like the way he kept talking, standing up to her. In a minute she was going to have to hurt him.
"You give food to bullies every day. Give that to one bully and get him to keep the others away from you."
"You think I never thought of that, stupid?" she said. "Only once he's bought, how I keep him. He won't fight for us."
"If he won't, then kill him," said the boy.
That made Poke mad, the stupid impossibility of it.
the power of the idea that she knew she could never lay hands on. She gave him a knee again, and this time kicked him when he went down. "Maybe I start by killing you."
"I'm not worth a bean, remember?" said the boy.
"You kill one bully, get another to fight for you. He want your food. He's scared of you, too." She didn't know what to say to such a preposterous idea.
"They eating you up," said the boy.
"Eating you up. So you got to kill one. Get him down. Everybody as small as me. Stones crack any size head."
"You make me sick," she said.
"'Cause you didn't think of it," he said. He was flirting with death, talking to her that way. If she injured him at all, he'd be finished. He must know that. But then, he had death living with him inside his flimsy little shirt already. Hard to see how it would matter if death came any closer. Poke looked around at her crew. She couldn't read their faces.
"I don't need no baby telling me to kill what we can't kill."
"Little kid come up behind him. You shove. He fall over," said the boy.
"Already you got some big stones. Bricks.
Hit him in the head. When you see brains, you done."
"He no good to me dead," she said. "I want my own bully. He keep us safe. I don't want no dead one."
The boy grinned.
"So now you like my idea," he said.
"Can't trust no bully," she answered.
"He watch out for you at the charity kitchen," said the boy.
"You get in at the kitchen." He kept looking her in the eye, but he was talking for the others to hear.
"He get you all in at the kitchen.
Little kid get into the kitchen, the big kids, they beat him," said Sergeant. He was 8, and mostly acted like he thought he was Poke's second in command, though truth was, she didn't have a second.
"You get you a bully, he make them go away."
"How he stop 2 bullies? 3 bullies? Asked Sergeant.
"Like I said," the boy answered. "You push him down. He not so big. You get your rocks. You be ready. Be into you a soldier? Don't they call you Sergeant?"
"Stop talking to him, Sarge," said Poke. "I don't know why any of us is talking to some 2-year-old.
"I'm 4, said the boy.
"What's your name?" asked Poke.
"Nobody ever said no name for me," he said.
"You mean you're so stupid you can't remember your own name?"
"Nobody ever said no name," he said again. Still he looked her in the eye, lying there on the ground, the crew around him.
"Ain't worth a bean," she said.
"Am so," he said.
"Yeah," said Sergeant. "One damn bean."
"So now you got a name," said Poke. "You go back and sit on that garbage can. I think about what you said."
"I need something to eat," said Bean.
"If I get me a bully, if what you said works, then maybe I give you something."
"I need something now," said Bean. She knew it was true. She reached into her pocket and took out 6 peanuts she had been saving. He sat up and took just 1 from her hand, put it in his mouth, and slowly chewed.
"Take them all," she said impatiently.
He held out his little hand. It was weak. He couldn't make a fist.
"Can't hold them all," he said. "Don't hold so good."
Damn, she was wasting perfectly good peanuts on a kid who was going to die anyway. But she was going to try his idea. It was audacious, but it was the first plan she'd ever heard that offered any hope of making things better, of changing something about their miserable life without her having to put on girl clothes and going into business. And since it was his idea, the crew had to see that she treated him fair,
That's how you stay crew boss. They always see you be fair. So she kept holding her hand out while he ate all 6 peanuts, one at a time. After he swallowed the last one, he looked her in the eye for another long moment and then said, "You better be ready to kill him. I want him alive. Be ready to kill him if he ain't the right one." With that, Bean toddled back across the street to his garbage can and laboriously climbed on top again to watch. "You ain't no 4 years old," Sergeant shouted over to him. "I'm 4, but I'm just little," he shouted back. Poke hushed Sergeant up, and they went looking for stones and bricks and cinder blocks. If they were going to have a little war, they'd best be armed.
Bean didn't like his new name, but it was a name, and having a name meant that somebody else knew who he was and needed something to call him, and that was a good thing. So were the 6 peanuts. His mouth hardly knew what to do with them. Chewing hurt. So did watching as Poke screwed up the plan he gave her. Bean didn't choose her because she was the smartest crew boss in Rotterdam. Quite the opposite. Her crew barely survived because her judgment wasn't that good. And she was too compassionate. Didn't have the brains to make sure she got enough food herself to look well-fed. So while her own crew knew she was nice and liked her, to strangers she didn't look prosperous. Didn't look good at her job. But if she really was good at her job, she would never have listened to him. He never would have got close. Or if she did listen and did like his idea, she would have got rid of him. That's the way it worked on the street. Nice kids died. Poke was almost too nice to stay alive. That's what Bean was counting on. But that's what he now feared. All this time he invested in watching people while his body ate itself up. It would be wasted if she couldn't bring it off. Not that Bean hadn't wasted a lot of time himself. At first, when he watched the way kids did things on the street, the way they were stealing from each other, at each other's throats, in each other's pockets, selling every part of themselves that they could sell, he saw how things could be better if somebody had any brains, but he didn't trust his own insight. He was sure there must be something else that he just didn't get. He struggled to learn more. Of everything. To learn to read so he'd know what the signs said on trucks and stores and wagons and bins. To learn enough Dutch and enough IF common to understand everything that was said around him. It didn't help that hunger constantly distracted him. He probably could have found more to eat if he hadn't spent so much time studying the people. But finally he realized. He already understood it. He had understood it from the start. There was no secret that Bean just didn't get yet because he was only little. The reason all these kids handled everything so stupidly was because they were stupid. They were stupid, and he was smart. So why was he starving to death while these kids were still alive? That was when he decided to act. That was when he picked Poke as his crew boss. And now he sat on a garbage can watching her blow it. She chose the wrong bully, that's the first thing she did. She needed a guy who made it on size alone, intimidating people. She needed somebody big and dumb, brutal but controllable. Instead, she thinks she needs somebody small. No, stupid, stupid. Bean wanted to scream at her as she saw her target coming, a bully who called himself Ashiel after the comics hero. He was little and mean and smart and quick, but he had a gimp leg. So she thought she could take him down more easily. Stupid. The idea isn't just to take him down. You can take anybody down the first time because they won't expect it. You need somebody who will stay down. But he said nothing. Couldn't get her mad at him. See what happens. See what Ashiel is like when he's beat. She'll see. It won't work, and she'll have to kill him and hide the body and try again with another bully before word gets out that there's a crew of little kids taking down bullies. So up comes Ashiel, swaggering. Or maybe that was just the rolling gait that his bent leg forced on him, and Poke makes an exaggerated show of cowering and trying to get away. Bad job, thought Bean. Ashiel gets it already. Something's wrong. You were supposed to act like you normally do. Stupid. So Ashiel looks around a lot more, wary. She tells him she's got something stashed. That part's normal, and she leads him into the trap in the alley. But look, he's holding back, being careful. It isn't going to work. But it does work, because of the gimp leg. Ashiel can see the trap being sprung, but he can't get away. A couple of little kids pile into the backs of his legs while Poke and Sergeant push him from the front, and down he goes. Then there's a couple of bricks hitting his body and his bad leg, and they're thrown hard. The little kids get it. They do their job, even if Poke is stupid. And yeah, that's good. Ashiel is scared. He thinks he's going to die. Bean was off his perch by now. Down the alley, watching, closer. Hard to see past the crowd. He pushes his way in, and the little kids, who are all bigger than he is, recognize him. They know he earned a view of this. They let him in. He stands right at Ashiel's head. Poke stands above him, holding a big cinder block, and she's talking. You get us into the food line at the shelter. Sure, right, I will, I promise. Don't believe him. Look at his eyes, checking for weakness. You get more food this way too, Ashiel. You get my crew. We get enough to eat, we have more strength, we bring more to you. You need a crew. The other bullies shove you out of the way, we've seen them. But with us, you don't gotta take no shit. See how we do it? An army, that's what we are. Okay, now he was getting it. It was a good idea, and he wasn't stupid, so it made sense to him. If this is so smart, Poke, how come you didn't do this before now? She had nothing to say to that. Instead, she glanced at Bean. Just a momentary glance, but Ashiel saw it, and Bean knew what he was thinking. It was so obvious. Kill him, said Bean. Don't be stupid, said Poke. He's in. That's right, said Ashiel. I'm in. It's a good idea. Kill him, said Bean. If you don't kill him now, he's going to kill you. You let this little walking turd get away with talking shit like this, said Ashiel. It's your life or his, said Bean. Kill him and take the next guy. The next guy won't have my bad leg, said Ashiel. The next guy won't think he needs you. I know I do. I'm in. I'm the one you want. It makes sense. Maybe Bean's warning made her more cautious. She didn't cave in quite yet. You won't decide later that you're embarrassed to have a bunch of little kids in your crew? It's your crew, not mine, said Ashiel. Liar, thought Bean. Don't you see that he's lying to you? What this is to me, said Ashiel. This is my family. These are my kid brothers and sisters. I got to look after my family, don't I? Bean saw at once that Ashiel had won. Powerful bully, and he had called these kids his sisters, his brothers. Bean could see the hunger in their eyes. Not the regular hunger for food, but the real hunger, the deep hunger, for family, for love, for belonging. They got a little of that by being in Poke's crew, but Ashiel was promising more. He had just beaten Poke's best offer. Now it was too late to kill him. Too late. But for a moment it looked as if Poke was so stupid she was going to go ahead and kill him after all. She raised the cinder block higher to crash it down. No, said Bean. You can't. He's family now. She lowered the cinder block to her waist. Slowly she turned to look at Bean. You get the hell out of here, she said. You no part of my crew. You get nothing here. No, said Ashiel. You better go ahead and kill me. You plan to treat him that way. Oh, that sounded brave. But Bean knew Ashiel wasn't brave, just smart. He had already won. It meant nothing that he was lying there on the ground and Polk still had the cinder block. It was his crew now. Polk was finished. It would be a while before anybody but Bean and Ashiel understood that, but the test of authority was here and now, and Ashiel was going to win it. "This little kid," said Ashiel. "He may not be part of your crew, but he's part of my family. You don't go telling my brother to get lost." Polk hesitated. A moment. A moment longer. Long enough. Ashiel sat up. He rubbed his bruises. He checked out his contusions. He looked in joking admiration to the little kids who had bricked him. "Damn, you bad." They laughed. Nervously at first. Would he hurt them because they hurt him? "Don't worry," he said. "You showed me what you can do. We have to do this to more than a couple of bullies, you'll see. I had to know you could do it right. Good job. What's your name?" One by one, he learned their names. Learned them and remembered them. Or when he missed one, he'd make a big deal about it, apologize, visibly work at remembering. 15 minutes later, they loved him. If he could do this, thought Bean, if he's this good at making people love him, why didn't he do it before? Because these fools always look up for power. People above you, they never want to share power with you. Why you look to them? They give you nothing. People below you, you give them hope, you give them respect, they give you power, because they don't think they have any, so they don't mind giving it up. Ashiel got to his feet, a little shaky, his bad leg more sore than usual. Everybody stood back, gave him some space. He could leave now if he wanted. Get away, never come back. Or go get some more bullies, come back and punish the crew. But he stood there, then smiled, reached into his pocket, took out the most incredible thing. A bunch of raisins. A whole handful of them. They looked at his hand as if it bore the mark of a nail in the palm. "Little brothers and sisters first," he said. "Littlest first." He looked at Bean. "You." "Not him," said the next littlest. "We don't even know him." "Bean was the one who wanted us to kill you," said another. "Bean," said Ashiel. "Bean, you were just looking out for my family, weren't you?" "Yes," said Bean. "You want a raisin?" Bean nodded. "You first. You the one brought us all together, okay?" Either Ashiel would kill him or he wouldn't. At this moment, all that mattered was the raisin. Bean took it, put it in his mouth, did not even bite down on it, just let his saliva soak it, bringing out the flavor of it. "You know," said Ashiel, "no matter how long you hold it in your mouth, it never turns back into a grape." "What's a grape?" Ashiel laughed at him, still not chewing. Then he gave out raisins to the other kids. Polk had never shared out so many raisins because she had never had so many to share. But the little kids wouldn't understand that. They'd think Polk gave us garbage and Ashiel gave us raisins. That's because they were stupid.
Chapter 2. Kitchen.
"I know you've already looked through this area, and you're probably almost done with Rotterdam, but something's been happening lately since you visited that... Oh, I don't know if it's really anything. I shouldn't have called."
"Tell me. I'm listening."
"There's always been fighting in the line. We try to stop them, but we only have a few volunteers, and they're needed to keep order inside the dining room, that and serve the food. So we know that a lot of kids who should get a turn can't even get in the line, because they're pushed out. And if we do manage to stop the bullies and let one of the little ones in, then they get beaten up afterwards. We never see them again. It's ugly."
"Survival of the fittest?"
"Of the cruelest. Civilization is supposed to be the opposite of that."
"You're civilized." They're not.
Anyway, it's changed all of a sudden, just in the past few days. I don't know why, but I just... You said that anything unusual, and whoever's behind it... I mean, can civilization suddenly evolve all over again in the middle of a jungle of children?
That's the only place it ever evolves. I'm through in Delft. There was nothing for us here. I already have enough blue plates.
Bean kept to the background during the weeks that followed. He had nothing to offer now. They already had his best idea. And he knew that gratitude wouldn't last long. He wasn't big and he didn't eat much, but if he was constantly underfoot, annoying people and chattering at them, it would soon become not only fun but popular to deny him food in hopes that he'd die or go away. Even so, he often felt Ashiel's eyes on him. He noticed this without fear. If Ashiel killed him, so be it. He had been a few days from death anyway. It would just mean his plan didn't work so well after all, but since it was his only plan, it didn't matter if it turned out not to have been good. If Ashiel remembered how Bean urged Poke to kill him, and of course, he did remember, and if Ashiel was planning how and when he would die, there was nothing Bean could do to prevent it. Sucking up wouldn't help. That would just look like weakness, and Bean had seen for a long time how bullies... And Ashiel was still a bully at heart, thrived on the terror of other children, how they treated people even worse when they showed their weakness. Nor would offering more clever ideas, first because Bean didn't have any, and second because Ashiel would think it was an affront to his authority. And the other kids would resent it if Bean kept acting like he thought he was the only one with a brain. They already resented him for having thought of this plan that had changed their lives. For the change was immediate. The very first morning, Ashiel had Sergeant go stand in the line at Helga's kitchen on Ert van Nestrand, because, he said, as long as we're going to get the crap beaten out of us anyway, we might as well try for the best free food in Rotterdam in case we get to eat before we die. He talked like that, but he had made them practice their moves till the last light of day the night before, so they worked together better, and they didn't give themselves away so soon, the way they did when they were going after him. The practice gave them confidence. Ashiel kept saying, they'll expect this, and they'll try that. And because he was a bully himself, they trusted him in a way they had never trusted Poke. Poke, being stupid, kept trying to act as if she was in charge, as if she had only delegated their training to Ashiel. Bean admired the way that Ashiel did not argue with her and did not change his plans or instructions in any way because of what she said. If she urged him to do what he was already doing, he'd keep doing it. There was no show of defiance, no struggle for power. Ashiel acted as if he had already won, and because the other kids followed him... He had. The line formed in front of Helga's early, and Ashiel watched carefully as bullies who arrived later inserted themselves in line in a kind of hierarchy. The bullies knew which ones got pride of place. Bean tried to understand the principle Ashiel used to pick which bully Sergeant should pick a fight with. It wasn't the weakest, but that was smart, since beating the weakest bully would only set them up for more fights every day. Nor was it the strongest. As Sergeant walked across the street, Bean tried to see what it was about the target bully that made Ashiel pick him. And then Bean realized. This was the strongest bully who had no friends with him. The target was big and he looked mean, so beating him would look like an important victory. But he talked to no one, greeted no one. He was out of his territory, and several of the other bullies were casting resentful glances at him, sizing him up. There might have been a fight here today even if Ashiel hadn't picked this soup line, this stranger. Sergeant was cool as you please, slipping into place directly in front of the target. For a moment, the target just stood there looking at him as if he couldn't believe what he was seeing. Surely this little kid would realize his deadly mistake and run away. But Sergeant didn't even act as if he noticed the target was there. "Hey," said the target. He shoved Sergeant hard, and from the angle of the push, Sergeant should have been propelled away from the line. But as Ashiel had told him, he planted a foot right away and launched himself forward, hitting the bully in front of the target in line, even though that was not the direction in which the target had pushed him. The bully in front turned around and snarled at Sergeant, who pleaded,
"He pushed me."
"He hit you himself," said the target.
"Do I look that stupid?" said Sergeant.
The bully in front sized up the target. A stranger. Tough, but not unbeatable. "Watch yourself, skinny boy." That was a dire insult among bullies, since it implied incompetence and weakness. "Watch your own self." During this exchange, Ashiel led a picked group of younger kids toward Sergeant, who was risking life and limb by staying right up between the two bullies. Just before reaching them, two of the younger kids darted through the line to the other side, taking up posts against the wall just beyond the target's range of vision. Then Ashiel started screaming.
"What the hell do you think you're doing, you turd-stained piece of toilet paper? I send my boy to hold my place in line and you shove him? You shove him into my friend here?"
Of course, they weren't friends at all. Ashiel was the lowest status bully in this part of Rotterdam, and he always took his place as the last of the bullies in line. But the target didn't know that, and he wouldn't have time to find out. For by the time the target was turned to face Ashiel, the boys behind him were already leaping against his calves. There was no waiting for the usual exchange of shoves and brags before the fight began. Ashiel began it and ended it with brutal swiftness. He pushed hard just as the younger boys hit, and the target hit the cobbled street hard. He lay there dazed, blinking. But already two other little kids were handing big, loose cobblestones to Ashiel, who smashed them down, one, two, on the target's chest. Bean could hear the ribs as they popped like twigs. Ashiel pulled him by his shirt and flopped him right back down on the street. He groaned, struggled to move, groaned again, lay still. The others in line had backed away from the fight. This was a violation of protocol. When bullies fought each other, they took it into the alleys, and they didn't try for serious injury. They fought until supremacy was clear and it was over. This was a new thing, using cobblestones, breaking bones. It scared them, not because Ashiel was so fearsome to look at, but because he had done the forbidden thing, and he had done it right out in the open. At once, Ashiel signaled Poke to bring the rest of the crew and fill in the gap in the line. Meanwhile, Ashiel strutted up and down the line, ranting at the top of his voice. "You can disrespect me. I don't care. I'm just a cripple. I'm just a guy with a gimp leg. But don't you go shoving my family. Don't you go shoving one of my children out of line. You hear me? Because if you do that, some truck's gonna come down this street and knock you down and break your bones, just like happened to this little pinprick. And next time, maybe your head's going to be what breaks till your brains fall out on the street. You gotta watch out for speeding trucks like the one that knocked down this fart for brains right here in front of my soup kitchen." There it was. The challenge. My kitchen. And Ashiel didn't hold back, didn't show a spark of timidity about it. He kept the rant going, limping up and down the line, staring each bully in the face, daring him to argue. Shadowing his movements on the other side of the line were the two younger boys who had helped take down the stranger, and Sergeant strutted at Ashiel's side, looking happy and smug. They reeked of confidence, while the other bullies kept glancing over their shoulders to see what those leg-grabbers behind them were doing. And it wasn't just talk and brag, either. When one of the bullies started looking belligerent, Ashiel went right up into his face. However, as he had planned beforehand, he didn't actually go after the belligerent one. He was ready for trouble, asking for it. Instead, the boys launched themselves at the bully directly after him in line. Just as they leapt, Ashiel turned and shoved the new target, screaming, "What do you think is so damn funny?" He had another cobblestone in his hands at once, standing over the fallen one, but he did not strike. "Go to the end of the line, you moron. You're lucky I'm letting you eat in my kitchen." It completely deflated the belligerent one, for the bully Ashiel knocked down and obviously could have smashed was the one next lower in status. So the belligerent one hadn't been threatened or harmed, and yet Ashiel had scored a victory right in his face, and he hadn't been a part of it. The door to the soup kitchen opened. At once Ashiel was with the woman who opened it, smiling, greeting her like an old friend. "Thank you for feeding us today," he said. "I'm eating last today. Thank you for bringing in my friends. Thank you for feeding my family." The woman at the door knew how the street worked. She knew Ashiel, too, and that something very strange was going on here. Ashiel always ate last of the bigger boys, and rather shamefacedly. But his new patronizing attitude hardly had time to get annoying before the first of Poke's crew came to the door. "My family," Ashiel announced proudly, passing each of the little kids into the hall. "You take good care of my children." Even Poke, he called his child. If she noticed the humiliation of it, though, she didn't show it. All she cared about was the miracle of getting into the soup kitchen. The plan had worked. And whether she thought of it as her plan or Bean's didn't matter to Bean in the least, at least not till he had the first soup in his mouth. He drank it as slowly as he could, but it was still gone so fast that he could hardly believe it. Was this all? And how had he managed to spill so much of the precious stuff on his shirt? Quickly, he stuffed his bread inside his clothing and headed for the door. Stashing the bread and leaving, that was Ashiel's idea, and it was a good one. Some of the bullies inside the kitchen were bound to plan retribution. The sight of little kids eating would be galling to them. They'd get used to it soon enough, Ashiel promised, but this first day it was important that all the little kids get out while the bullies were still eating. When Bean got to the door, the line was still coming in, and Ashiel stood by the door, chatting with a woman about the tragic accident there in the line. Paramedics must have been summoned to carry the injured boy away. He was no longer groaning in the street. "It could have been one of the little kids," he said. "We need a policeman out here to watch the traffic. That driver would never have been so careless if there was a cop here." The woman agreed.
"It could have been awful. They said half his ribs were broken and his lung was punctured."
She looked mournful, her hands fretting. "This line forms up when it's still dark. It's dangerous. Can't we have a light out here?" "I've got my children to think about," said Ashiel. "Don't you want my little kids to be safe? Or am I the only one who cares about them?" The woman murmured something about money and how the soup kitchen didn't have much of a budget. Poke was counting children at the door while Sergeant ushered them out into the street. Bean, seeing that Ashiel was trying to get the adults to protect them in line, decided the time was right for him to be useful. Because this woman was compassionate and Bean was by far the smallest child, he knew he had the most power over her. He came up to her, tugged on her woolen skirt.
"Thank you for watching over us," he said. "It's the first time I ever got into a real kitchen. Papa Ashiel told us that you would keep us safe so we little ones could eat here every day."
"Oh, you poor thing. Oh, look at you."
Tears streamed down the woman's face.
Oh, you poor darling."
She embraced him. Ashiel looked on, beaming. "I got to watch out for them," he said quietly. "I got to keep them safe." Then he led his family, it was no longer in any sense Poke's crew, away from Helga's kitchen, all marching in a line, till they rounded the corner of a building, and then they ran like hell, joining hands and putting as much distance between them and Helga's kitchen as they could. For the rest of the day, they were going to have to lie low. In twos and threes, the bullies would be looking for them. But they could lie low, because they didn't need to forage for food today. The soup already gave them more calories than they normally got, and they had the bread. Of course, the first tax on that bread belonged to Ashiel, who had eaten no soup. Each child reverently offered his bread to their new papa, and he took a bite from each one and slowly chewed it and swallowed it before reaching for the next offered bread. It was quite a lengthy ritual. Ashiel took a mouthful of every piece of bread except two. Poke's and Bean's.
Thanks, said Poke.
She was so stupid, she thought it was a gesture of respect. Bean knew better. By not eating their bread, Ashiel was putting them outside the family. We are dead, thought Bean. That's why Bean hung back, why he held his tongue and remained unobtrusive during the next few weeks. That was also why he endeavored never to be alone. Always he was within arm's reach of one of the other kids. But he didn't linger near Poke. That was a picture he didn't want to get locked in anyone's memory, him tagging along with Poke. From the second morning, Helga's soup kitchen had an adult outside watching, and a new light fixture on the third day. By the end of a week, the adult guardian was a cop. Even so, Ashiel never brought his group out of hiding until the adult was there, and then he would march the whole family right to the front of the line and loudly thank the bully in first position for helping him look out for his children by saving them a place in line. It was hard on all of them, though, seeing how the bullies looked at them. They had to be on their best behavior while the doorkeeper was watching, but murder was on their minds. And it didn't get better. The bullies didn't get used to it, despite Ashiel's bland assurances that they would. So even though Bean was determined to be unobtrusive, he knew that something had to be done to turn the bullies away from their hatred, and Ashiel, who thought the war was over and victory achieved, wasn't going to do it. So as Bean took his place in line one morning, he deliberately hung back to be last of the family. Usually Poke brought up the rear. It was her way of trying to pretend that she was somehow involved in ushering the little ones in. But this time Bean deliberately got in place behind her, with the hate-filled stare of the bully who should have had first position burning on his head. Right at the door, where the woman was standing with Ashiel, both of them looking proud of his family, Bean turned to face the bully behind him and asked, in his loudest voice, "Where's your children? How come you don't bring your children to the kitchen?" The bully would have snarled something vicious, but the woman at the door was watching with raised eyebrows. "You look after little children, too?" she asked. It was obvious she was delighted about the idea and wanted the answer to be yes. And stupid as this bully was, he knew that it was good to please adults who gave out food. So he said, "Of course I do."
"Well, you can bring them, you know, just like Papa Ashiel here. We are always glad to see the little children."
Again, Bean piped up.
"They let people with little children come inside first. You know, that's such a good idea," said the woman. "I think we'll make that a rule. Now let's move along. We're holding up the hungry children."
Bean did not even glance at Ashiel as he went inside. Later, after breakfast, as they were performing the ritual of giving bread to Ashiel, Bean made it a point to offer his bread yet again, though there was danger in reminding everyone that Ashiel never took a share from him. Today, though, he had to see how Ashiel regarded him for being so bold and intrusive. "If they all bring little kids, they'll run out of soup faster," said Ashiel coldly. His eyes said nothing at all, but that, too, was a message.
"If they all become papas," said Bean, "they won't be trying to kill us."
At that, Ashiel's eyes came to life a little. He reached down and took the bread from Bean's hand. He bit down on the crust, tore away a huge piece of it. More than half. He jammed it into his mouth and chewed it slowly, then handed the remnant of the bread back to Bean. It left Bean hungry that day, but it was worth it. It didn't mean that Ashiel wasn't going to kill him someday, but at least he wasn't separating him from the rest of the family anymore. And that remnant of bread was far more food than he used to get in a day. Or a week, for that matter. He was filling out. Muscles grew in his arms and legs again. He didn't get exhausted just crossing a street. He could keep up easily now when the others jogged along. They all had more energy. They were healthy, compared to street urchins who didn't have a papa. Everyone could see it. the other bullies would have no trouble recruiting families of their own.
Sister Carlotta was a recruiter for the International Fleet's training program for children. It had caused a lot of criticism in her order, and finally she won the right to do it by pointedly mentioning the Earth Defense Treaty, which was a veiled threat. If she reported the order for obstructing her work on behalf of the IF, the order could lose its tax-exempt and draft-exempt status. She knew, however, that when the war ended and the treaty expired, she would no doubt be a nun in search of a home, for there would be no place for her among the Sisters of St. Nicholas. But her mission in life, she knew, was to care for little children, and the way she saw it, if the buggers won the next round of the war, all the little children of the earth would die. Surely God did not mean that to happen, but in her judgment at least, God did not want his servants to sit around waiting for God to work miracles to save them. He wanted his servants to labor as best they could to bring about righteousness. So it was her business, as a sister of St. Nicholas, to use her training in child development in order to serve the war effort. As long as the IF thought it worthwhile to recruit extraordinarily gifted children to train them for command roles in the battles to come, then she would help them by finding the children that would otherwise be overlooked. They would never pay anyone to do something as fruitless as scouring the filthy streets of every overcrowded city in the world, searching among the malnourished, savage children who begged and stole and starved there, for the chance of finding a child with the intelligence and ability and character to make a go of it in battle school was remote. To God, however, all things were possible. Did he not say that the weak would be made strong, and the strong weak? Was Jesus not born to a humble carpenter and his bride in the country province of Galilee? The brilliance of children born to privilege and bounty, or even to bare sufficiency, would hardly show forth the miraculous power of God. And it was the miracle she was searching for. God had made humankind in his own image. Male and female, he created them. No buggers from another planet were going to blow down what God had created. Over the years, though, her enthusiasm, if not her faith, had flagged a little. Not one child had done better than a marginal success on the tests. Those children were indeed taken from the streets and trained, but it wasn't battle school. They weren't on the course that might lead them to save the world. So she began to think that her real work was a different kind of miracle, giving the children hope, finding even a few to be lifted out of the morass, to be given special attention by the local authorities. She made it a point to indicate the most promising children and then follow up on them with email to the authorities. Some of her early successes had already graduated from college. They said they owed their lives to Sister Carlotta, but she knew they owed their lives to God. Then came the call from Helga Brown in Rotterdam, telling her of certain changes in the children who came to her charity kitchen. Civilization, she had called it. The children, all by themselves, were becoming civilized. Sister Carlotta came at once to see a thing which sounded like a miracle, and indeed, when she beheld it with her own eyes, she could hardly believe it. The line for breakfast was now flooded with little children. Instead of the bigger ones shoving them out of the way or intimidating them into not even bothering to try, they were shepherding them, protecting them, making sure each got his share. Helga had panicked at first, fearful that she would run out of food, but she found that when potential benefactors saw how these children were acting, donations increased. There was always plenty now, not to mention an increase in volunteers helping.
I was at the point of despair, she told Sister Carlotta. On the day when they told me that a truck had hit one of the boys and broken his ribs. Of course, it was a lie, but there he lay, right in the line. They didn't even try to conceal him from me. I was going to give up. I was going to leave the children to God and move in with my oldest boy in Frankfurt, where the government is not required by treaty to admit every refugee from any part of the globe. I'm glad you didn't, said Sister Carlotta. You can't leave them to God when God has left them to us. Well, that's the funny thing. Perhaps that fight in the line woke up these children to the horror of the life they were living. For that very day, one of the big boys, but the weakest of them, with a bad leg, they call him Achille. Well, I suppose I gave him the name years ago because Achilles had a weak heel, you know. Achille, anyway. He showed up in the line with a group of little children. He as much as asked me for protection, warning me that what happened to that poor boy with the broken ribs, he was the one I called Ulysses, because he wanders from kitchen to kitchen. He's still in hospital. His ribs were completely smashed in. Can you believe the brutality? Achille, anyway, he warned me that the same thing might happen to his little ones. So I made the special effort. I came early to watch over the line and badgered the police to finally give me a man, off-duty volunteers at first, on part pay, but now regulars. You'd think I would have been watching over the line all along, but don't you see? It didn't make any difference, because they didn't do their intimidation in the line. They did it where I couldn't see. So no matter how I watched over them, it was only the bigger, meaner boys who ended up in the line. And yes, I know they're God's children, too, and I fed them and tried to preach the gospel to them as they ate. But I was losing heart. They were so heartless themselves, so devoid of compassion. But Achille, anyway, he had taken on a whole group of them, including the littlest child I ever saw in the streets. It just broke my heart. They call him Bean. So small. He looked to be 2 years old, though I've learned since that he thinks he's 4, and he talks like he's 10 at least. Very precocious. I suppose that's why he lived long enough to get under Achille's protection. But he was skin and bone. People say that when somebody's skinny. But in the case of this little Bean, it was true. I didn't know how he had muscles enough to walk. To stand. His arms and legs were as thin as an ant. Oh, isn't that awful? To compare him to the buggers. Or I should say, the formics, since they're saying now that buggers is a bad word in English, even though IF Common is not English, even though it began that way, don't you think? So, Helga, you're telling me it began with this Achille. Do call me Hazy. We're friends now, aren't we? She gripped Sister Carlotta's hand. You must meet this boy. Courage. Vision. Test him, Sister Carlotta. He is a leader of men. He is a civilizer. Sister Carlotta did not point out that civilizers didn't often make good soldiers. It was enough that the boy was interesting, and she had missed him the first time around. It was a reminder to her that she must be thorough. In the dark of early morning, Sister Carlotta arrived at the door where the line had already formed. Helga beckoned to her, then pointed ostentatiously at a rather good-looking young man surrounded by smaller children. Only when she got closer and saw him take a couple of steps did she realize just how bad his right leg was. She tried to diagnose the condition. Was it an early case of rickets? A club foot, left uncorrected? A break that healed wrong? It hardly mattered. Battle school would not take him with such an injury. Then she saw the adoration in the eyes of the children, the way they called him Papa, and looked to him for approval.
Few adult men were good fathers. This boy of, what, 11, 12, had already learned to be an extraordinarily good father. Protector, provider, king, God to his little ones. Even as ye do it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me. Christ had a special place deep in his heart for this boy, Achille. So she would test him, and maybe the leg could be corrected. Or, failing that, she could surely find a place for him in some good school in one of the cities of the Netherlands. Pardon, the international territory that was not completely overwhelmed by the desperate poverty of refugees. He refused. "I can't leave my children," he said. "But surely one of the others can look after them." A girl who dressed as a boy spoke up. "I can." But it was obvious she could not. She was too small herself. Achille was right. His children depended on him, and to leave them would be irresponsible. The reason she was here was because he was civilized. Civilized men do not leave their children. "Then I will come to you," she said. "After you eat, take me where you spend your days, and let me teach you all in a little school. Only for a few days, but that would be good, wouldn't it?" It would be good. It had been a long time since Sister Carlotta had actually taught a group of children, and never had she been given such a class as this. Just when her work had begun to seem futile even to her, God gave her such a chance. It might even be a miracle. Wasn't it the business of Christ to make the lame walk? If Achille did well on the tests, then surely God would let the leg also be fixed, would let it be within the reach of medicine. "School's good," said Achille. "None of these little ones can read." Sister Carlotta knew, of course, that if Achille could read, he certainly couldn't do it well. But for some reason, perhaps some almost unnoticeable movement, when Achille said that none of the little ones could read, the smallest of them all, the one called Bean, caught her eye. She looked at him, into eyes with sparks in them like distant campfires in the darkest night, and she knew that he knew how to read. She knew, without knowing how, that it was not Achille at all, that it was this little one that God had brought her here to find. She shook off the feeling. It was Achille who was the civilizer, doing the work of Christ. It was the leader that the IF would want, not the weakest and smallest of the disciples.
Bean stayed as quiet as possible during the school sessions, never speaking up and never giving an answer, even when Sister Carlotta tried to insist. He knew that it wouldn't be good for him to let anyone know that he could already read and do numbers, nor that he could understand every language spoken in the street, picking up new languages the way other children picked up stones. Whatever Sister Carlotta was doing, whatever gifts she had to bestow, if it ever seemed to the other children that Bean was trying to show them up, trying to get ahead of them, he knew that he would not be back for another day of school. And even though she mostly taught things he already knew how to do, in her conversation there were many hints of a wider world, of great knowledge and wisdom. No adult had ever taken the time to speak to them like this, and he luxuriated in the sound of high language well spoken. When she taught, it was in IF common, of course, that being the language of the street, but since many of the children had also learned Dutch, and some were even native Dutch speakers, she would often explain hard points in that language. When she was frustrated, though, and muttered under her breath, that was in Spanish, the language of the merchants of Jonker Franstraat, and he tried to piece together the meanings of new words from her muttering. Her knowledge was a banquet, and if he remained quiet enough, he would be able to stay and feast.
School had only been going for a week, however, when he made a mistake. She passed out papers to them, and they had writing on them. Bean read his paper at once. It was a pretest, and the instruction said to circle the right answers to each question. So he began circling answers and was halfway down the page when he realized that the entire group had fallen silent. They were all looking at him because Sister Carlotta was looking at him. "What are you doing, Bean?" she asked. "I haven't even told you what to do yet. Please give me your paper." Stupid, inattentive, careless. If you die for this, Bean, you deserve it. He handed her the paper. She looked at it, then looked back at him very closely. "Finish it," she said. He took the paper back from her hand. His pencil hovered over the page. He pretended to be struggling with the answer. "You did the first 15 in about a minute and a half," said Sister Carlotta. "Please don't expect me to believe that you're suddenly having a hard time with the next question." Her voice was dry and sarcastic. "I can't do it," he said. "I was just playing anyway." "Don't lie to me," said Carlotta. "Do the rest." He gave up and did them all. It didn't take long. They were easy. He handed her the paper. She glanced over it and said nothing. "I hope the rest of you will wait until I finish the instructions and read you the questions. If you try to guess at what the hard words are, you'll get all the answers wrong." Then she proceeded to read each question and all the possible answers out loud. Only then could the other children set their marks on the papers. Sister Carlotta didn't say another thing to call attention to Bean after that, but the damage was done. As soon as school was over, Sergeant came over to Bean. "So you can read," he said. Bean shrugged. "You've been lying to us," said Sergeant. "Never said I couldn't. Showed us all up. How come you didn't teach us?" "Because I was trying to survive," Bean said silently. "Because I didn't want to remind Ashiel that I was the smart one who thought up the original plan that got him this family. If he remembers that, he'll also remember who it was who told Poke to kill him." The only answer he actually gave was a shrug. "Don't like it when somebody holds out on us." Sergeant nudged him with a foot. Bean did not have to be given a map. He got up and jogged away from the group. School was out for him. Maybe breakfast, too. He'd have to wait till morning to find that out. He spent the afternoon alone on the streets. He had to be careful. As the smallest and least important of Ashiel's family, he might be overlooked. But it was more likely that those who hated Ashiel would have taken special notice of Bean as one of the most memorable. They might take it into their heads that killing Bean or beating him to paste and leaving him would make a dandy warning to Ashiel that he was still resented, even though life was better for everybody. Bean knew there were plenty of bullies who felt that way, especially the ones who weren't able to maintain a family because they kept being too mean with the little children. The little ones learned quickly that when a papa got too nasty, they could punish him by leaving him alone at breakfast and attaching themselves to some other family. They would eat before him. They would have someone else's protection from him. He would eat last. If they ran out of food, he would get nothing, and Helga wouldn't even mind because he wasn't a papa. He wasn't watching out for little ones. So those bullies, those marginal ones, they hated the way things worked these days, and they didn't forget that it was Ashiel who had changed it all. Nor could they go to some other kitchen. The word had spread among the adults who gave out food, and now all the kitchens had a rule that groups with little children got to be first in line. If you couldn't hold on to a family, you could get pretty hungry. And nobody looked up to you. Still, Bean couldn't resist trying to get close enough to some of the other families to hear their talk, find out how the other groups worked. The answer was easy to learn. They didn't work all that well. Ashiel really was a good leader. That sharing of bread? None of the other groups did that.
But there was a lot of punishing, the bully smacking kids who didn't do what he wanted, taking their bread away from them because they didn't do something or didn't do it quickly enough. Poke had chosen right, after all. By dumb luck, or maybe she wasn't all that stupid. Because she had picked not just the weakest bully, the easiest to beat, but also the smartest, the one who understood how to win and hold the loyalty of others. All Ashiel had ever needed was the chance. Except that Ashiel still didn't share her bread, and now she was beginning to realize that this was a bad thing, not a good one. Bean could see it in her face when she watched the others do the ritual of sharing with Ashiel. Because he got soup now. Helga brought it to him at the door. He took much smaller pieces, and instead of biting them off, he tore them and ate them with a smile. Poke never got that smile from him. Ashiel was never going to forgive her, and Bean could see that she was beginning to feel the pain of that. For she loved Ashiel now, too, the way the other children did, and the way he kept her apart from the others was a kind of cruelty. Maybe that's enough for him, thought Bean. Maybe that's his whole vengeance. Bean happened to be curled up behind a newsstand when several bullies began a conversation near him. He's full of brag about how Ashiel is going to pay for what he did. Oh, right. Ulysses is going to punish him, right? Well, maybe not directly. Ashiel and his stupid family will just take him apart. And this time they won't aim for his chest. He said so, didn't he? Break open his head and put his brains on the street. That's what Ashiel will do. He's still just a cripple. Ashiel gets away with everything. Give it up. I'm hoping Ulysses does it. Kills him, flat out. And then none of us take in any of his bastards. You got that? Nobody takes them in. Let them all die. Put them all in the river. The talk went on that way until the boys drifted away from the newsstand. Then Bean got up and went in search of Ashiel.
Chapter 3. Payback.
I think I have someone for you.
You've thought that before.
He's a born leader, but he does not meet your physical specifications.
Then you'll pardon me if I don't waste time on him.
If he passes your exacting intellectual and personality requirements, it is quite possible that for a minuscule portion of the brass button or toilet paper budget of the IF, his physical limitations might be repaired.
I never knew nuns could be sarcastic.
I can't reach you with a ruler. Sarcasm is my last resort.
Let me see the tests.
I'll let you see the boy. And while we're at it, I'll let you see another.
Also physically limited?
Small. Young. But so was the Wigan boy, I hear. And this one. Somehow on the streets. He taught himself to read.
Ah, Sister Carlotta. You help me fill the empty hours of my life.
Keeping you out of mischief is how I serve God.
Bean went straight to Ashiel with what he heard. It was too dangerous to have Ulysses out of the hospital and word going around that he meant to get even for his humiliation. I thought that was all behind us, said Poke sadly. The fighting, I mean. Ulysses has been in bed for all this time, said Ashiel. Even if he knows about the changes, he hasn't had time to get how it works yet. So we stick together, said Sergeant. Keep you safe. It might be safer for all, said Ashiel, if I disappear for a few days. To keep you safe.
Then how will we get in to eat? Asked one of the younger ones. They'll never let us in without you.
Follow Poke, said Ashiel. Helga at the door will let you in just the same.
What if Ulysses gets you? Asked one of the young ones.
He rubbed the tears out of his eyes, lest he be shamed. Then I'll be dead, said Ashiel. I don't think he'll be content to put me in the hospital. The child broke down crying, which set another to wailing, and soon it was a choir of boo-hoos, with Ashiel shaking his head and laughing. I'm not going to die. You'll be safe if I'm out of the way, and I'll come back after Ulysses has time to cool down and get used to the system. Bean watched and listened in silence. He didn't think Ashiel was handling it right, but he had given the warning, and his responsibility was over. For Ashiel to go into hiding was begging for trouble. It would be taken as a sign of weakness. Ashiel slipped away that night to go somewhere that he couldn't tell them so that nobody could accidentally let it slip. Bean toyed with the idea of following him to see what he really did, but realized he would be more useful with the main group. After all, Poke would be their leader now, and Poke was only an ordinary leader. In other words, stupid. She needed Bean, even if she didn't know it. That night, Bean tried to keep watch for what he did not know. At last he did sleep and dreamed of school, only it wasn't the sidewalk or alley school with Sister Carlotta. It was a real school, with tables and chairs. But in the dream, Bean couldn't sit at a desk. Instead, he hovered in the air over it, and when he wanted to, he flew anywhere in the room. Up to the ceiling, into a crevice in the wall, into a secret dark place, flying upward and upward as it got warmer and warmer and... He woke in darkness. The cold breeze stirred. He needed to pee. He also wanted to fly. Having the dream end almost made him cry out with the pain of it. He couldn't remember ever dreaming of flying before. Why did he have to be little, with these stubby legs to carry him from place to place? When he was flying, he could look down at everyone and see the tops of their silly heads. He could pee or poop on them like a bird. He wouldn't have to be afraid of them, because if they got mad, he could fly away and they could never catch him. Of course, if I could fly, everyone else could fly too, and I'd still be the smallest and slowest, and they'd poop and pee on me anyway. There was no going back to sleep. Bean could feel that in himself. He was too frightened, and he didn't know why. He got up and went into the alley to pee. Poke was already there. She looked up and saw him. "Leave me alone for a minute," she said. "No," he said. "Don't give me any crap, little boy," she said. "I know you squat to pee," he said, "and I'm not looking anyway." Glaring, she waited until he turned his back to urinate against the wall. "I guess if you were going to tell about me, you already would have," she said. "They all know you're a girl, Poke. When you're not there, Papa Ashiel talks about you as she and her. He's not my papa." "So I figured," said Bean. He waited, facing the wall. "You can turn around now." She was up and fastening her pants again. "I'm scared of something, Poke," said Bean.
"What?"
"I don't know."
"You don't know what you're scared of?"
"That's why it's so scary."
She gave a soft, sharp laugh. "Bean, all that means is that you're 4 years old. Little kids see shapes in the night, or they don't see shapes. Either way, they're scared."
"Not me," said Bean. "When I'm scared, it's because something's wrong."
"Ulysses is looking to hurt Ashiel, that's what."
"That wouldn't make you sad, would it?"
She glared at him.
"We're eating better than ever. Everybody's happy. It was your plan.
And I never cared about being the boss."
"But you hate him," said Bean.
She hesitated.
"It feels like he's always laughing at me." "How do you know what little kids are scared of?"
"'Cause I used to be one," said Poke. "And I remember."
"Ulysses isn't going to hurt Ashiel," said Bean.
"I know that," said Poke.
"Because you're planning to find Ashiel and protect him."
"I'm planning to stay right here and watch out for the children."
"Or else maybe you're planning to find Ulysses first and kill him."
"How?"
"He's bigger than me, by a lot."
"You didn't come out here to pee," said Bean. "Or else your bladder's the size of a gumball."
"You listened?"
Bean shrugged. "You wouldn't let me watch." You think too much, but you don't know enough to make sense of what's going on.
I think Ashiel was lying to us about what he's going to do, said Bean. And I think you're lying to me right now.
Get used to it, said Polk. The world is full of liars.
Ulysses doesn't care who he kills, said Bean. He'd be just as happy to kill you as Ashiel.
Polk shook her head impatiently.
Ulysses is nothing.
He isn't going to hurt anybody. He's all brag.
So why are you up? Asked Bean.
Polk shrugged.
You're going to try to kill Ashiel, aren't you? Said Bean. And make it look like Ulysses did it.
She rolled her eyes. Did you drink a big glass of stupid juice tonight? I'm smart enough to know you're lying.
Go back to sleep, she said.
Go back to the other children.
He regarded her for a while, and then obeyed. Or rather, seemed to obey.
He went back into the crawl space where they slept these days, but immediately crept out the back way and clambered up crates, drums, low walls, high walls, and finally got up onto a low-hanging roof. He walked to the edge in time to see Polk slip out of the alley into the street. She was going somewhere. To meet someone.
Bean slid down a pipe onto a rain barrel and scurried along the street after her. He tried to be quiet, but she wasn't trying, and there were other noises of the city, so she never heard his footfalls. He clung to the shadows of walls, but didn't dodge around too much. It was pretty straightforward following her. She only turned twice. Headed for the river. Meeting someone. Bean had two guesses. Either it was Ulysses or Ashiel. Who else did she know that wasn't already asleep in the nest? But then, why meet either of them? To plead with Ulysses for Ashiel's life? To heroically offer herself in his place? Or to try to persuade Ashiel to come back and face down Ulysses instead of hiding? No, these were all things that Bean might have thought of doing. But Polk didn't think that far ahead. Polk stopped in the middle of an open space on the dock and looked around. Then she saw what she was looking for. Bean strained to see. Someone waiting in a deep shadow. Bean climbed up on a big packing crate, trying to get a better view. He heard the two voices, both children, but he couldn't make out what they were saying. Whoever it was, he was taller than Polk. But that could be either Ashiel or Ulysses. The boy wrapped his arms around Polk and kissed her. This was really weird. Bean had seen grown-ups do that plenty of times, but what would kids do it for? Polk was 9 years old. Of course, there were whores that age, but everybody knew that the Johns who bought them were perverts. Bean had to get closer to hear what they were saying. He dropped down the back of the packing crate and slowly walked into the shadow of a kiosk. They, as if to oblige him, turned to face him. In the deep shadow, he was invisible, at least if he kept still. He couldn't see them any better than they could see him, but he could hear snatches of their conversation now. You promised, Polk was saying.
The guy mumbled in return. A boat passing on the river scanned a spotlight across the riverside and showed the face of the boy Polk was with. It was Ashiel. Bean didn't want to see any more. To think he had once believed Ashiel would someday kill Polk. This thing between girls and boys was something he just didn't get. In the midst of hate, this happens. Just when Bean was beginning to make sense of the world. He slipped away and down the street. But he did not head back to their nest in the crawlspace, not yet. For even though he had all the answers, his heart was still jumping. Something is wrong, it was saying to him. Something is wrong. And then he remembered that Polk wasn't the only one hiding something from him. Ashiel had also been lying. Hiding something. Some plan. Was it just this meeting with Polk? Then why all this business about hiding from Ulysses? To take Polk as his girl, he didn't have to hide to do that. He could do that right out in the open. Some bullies did that, the older ones. They usually didn't take 9-year-olds, though. Was that what Ashiel was hiding?
You promised, Poke said to Ashiel there on the dock.
What did Ashiel promise?
That was why Poke came to him. To pay him for his promise.
But what could Ashiel be promising her that he wasn't already giving her as part of his family? Ashiel didn't have anything.
So he must have been promising not to do something.
Not to kill her?
Then that would be too stupid even for Poke to go off alone with Ashiel.
Not to kill me, thought Bean. That's the promise. Not to kill me. Only I'm not the one in danger. Or not the most danger. I might have said to kill him, but Poke was the one who knocked him down, who stood over him.
That picture must still be in Ashiel's mind. All the time he must remember it, must dream about it. Him lying on the ground, a 9-year-old girl standing over him with a cinder block threatening to kill him. A cripple like him, somehow he had made it into the ranks of the bullies. So he was tough, but always mocked by the boys with 2 good legs, the lowest status bully. And the lowest moment of his life had to be then, when a 9-year-old girl knocked him down and a bunch of little kids stood over him.
Poke, he blames you most. You're the one he has to smash in order to wipe out the agony of that memory.
Now it was clear. Everything Ashiel had said today was a lie. He wasn't hiding from Ulysses. He would face Ulysses down. Probably still would tomorrow. But when he faced Ulysses, Ashiel would have a much bigger grievance.
You killed Poke!
He would scream the accusation. Ulysses would look so stupid and weak, denying it after all the bragging he'd done about how he'd get even. He might even admit to killing her just for the brag of it. And then Ashiel would strike at Ulysses and nobody would blame him for killing the boy. It wouldn't be mere self-defense. It would be defense of his family. Ashiel was just too damn smart. And patient. Waiting to kill Poke until there was somebody else who could be blamed for it. Bean ran back to warn her. As fast as his little legs would move, the longest strides he could take. He ran forever. There was nobody there on the dock where Poke had met Ashiel. Bean looked around helplessly. He thought of calling out, but that would be stupid. Just because it was Poke that Ashiel hated most didn't mean that he had forgiven Bean, even if he did let Bean give him bread.
Or maybe I've gone crazy over nothing.
He was hugging her, wasn't he? She came willingly, didn't she? There are things between boys and girls that I just don't understand. Ashiel is a provider, a protector, not a murderer. It's my mind that works that way. My mind that thinks of killing someone who is helpless just because he might pose a danger later. Ashiel is the good one. I'm the bad one. The criminal. Ashiel is the one who knows how to love. I'm the one who doesn't. Bean walked to the edge of the dock and looked across the channel. The water was covered with a low flowing mist. On the far bank, the lights of Bumchistrat twinkled like Sinterklaas Day. The waves lapped like tiny kisses against the pilings. He looked down into the river at his feet. Something was bobbing in the water, bumped up against the wharf. Bean looked at it for a while, uncomprehending. But then he understood that he had known all along what it was. He just didn't want to believe it. It was Poke. She was dead. It was just as Bean had feared. Everybody on the street would believe that Ulysses was guilty of the murder, even if nothing could be proved. Bean had been right about everything. Whatever it was that passed between boys and girls, it didn't have the power to block hatred, vengeance for humiliation. And as Bean stood there looking down into the water, he realized,
I either have to tell what happened right now, this minute, to everybody, or I have to decide never to tell anybody, because if Ashiel gets any hint that I saw what I saw tonight, he'll kill me and not give it a second thought. Ashiel would simply say, "Ulysses strikes again." Then he can pretend to be avenging two deaths, not one, when he kills Ulysses. No, all Bean could do was keep silence. Pretend that he hadn't seen Poke's body floating in the river, her upturned face clearly recognizable in the moonlight. She was stupid. Stupid not to see through Ashiel's plans. Stupid to trust him in any way. Stupid not to listen to me. As stupid as I was, to walk away instead of calling out a warning, maybe saving her life by giving her a witness that Ashiel could not hope to catch and therefore could not silence. She was the reason Bean was alive. She was the one who gave him a name. She was the one who listened to his plan. And now she had died for it, and he could have saved her. Sure, he told her at the start to kill Ashiel, but in the end she had been right to choose him. He was the only one of the bullies who could have figured it all out and brought it off with such style. But Bean had also been right. Ashiel was a champion liar, and when he decided that Poke would die, he began building up the lies that would surround the murder. Lies that would get Poke off by herself where he could kill her without witnesses. Lies to alibi himself in the eyes of the younger kids. I trusted him, thought Bean. I knew what he was from the start, and yet I trusted him. Oh, Poke, you poor, stupid, kind, decent girl. You saved me and I let you down. It's not just my fault. She's the one who went off alone with him. Alone with him, trying to save my life? What a mistake, Poke, to think of anyone but yourself. Am I going to die from her mistakes, too? No. I'll die from my own damn mistakes. Not tonight, though. Ashiel had not set any plan in motion to get Bean off by himself. But from now on, when he lay awake at night, unable to drift off, he would think about how Ashiel was just waiting, biding his time, till the day when Bean, too, would find himself in the river.